Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
To Iraq now, where tempers are boiling over. An unprecedented heat wave has strained the power grid, and thousands have taken to the street to protest frequent cuts to electricity. The heat wave comes at the same time as the one-year anniversary of the siege of Sinjar by the self-proclaimed Islamic State. The siege forced thousands of minority Yazidis to flee and prompted a U.S. airstrike campaign. Mitch Prothro is Iraq Bureau Chief for McClatchy. He joins us from Erbil, where it's 111 degrees, by the way. But Mitch, before we talk about the heat, tell us about Sinjar and what's happened to the Yazidis in the last year.
Well, thousands of Yazidis are still missing. Some people have gotten out. The last numbers I heard were around 3,000 to 4,000, with tens of thousands displaced in refugee camps, mostly in northern Iraq. Sinjar is a relatively mid-sized city that itself is still held by the Islamic State. Having said that, the area around it is a lot of desert and sort of rocky hills. There were famous pictures of that last year where the Yazidis were fleeing to this mountainous region to get away from the Islamic State. That area is currently held by a mix, again, of PKK-affiliated fighters and the Kurdish Peshmerga here in Iraq. So the city itself is still in the hands of the Islamic State. The surrounding areas have been very much stabilized.
Last week, you had a fascinating story from Syria about a setback on the U.S. side of things on its effort to combat ISIS. Commanders of the forces being trained by Americans kidnapped by al-Qaeda. What's going on there, and what does it say about what's going on with the U.S. policy in the region?
Look, the U.S. policy towards arming and supporting the Syrian rebels, if there is one, it's been neglect while occasionally talking about possible future programs. But what they did do was they put together a $500 million program in which they were going to train Syrian rebels that were willing to come in, be vetted to make sure that they weren't Islamists, and that these guys would be trained and sent back into Syria, not to fight the Syrian regime, but to help fight against the Islamic State. Mm. They did manage to put together a few score, as we'd say. I've heard 54. I've also heard 60 that were part of an initial pilot program that were basically being sent in to start the process rolling, and that these guys had been vetted and trained and led by a fairly well-known commander of what they call the 30th Division of the Syrian Rebel Army. Upon entering into Syria almost immediately after lunch, they were arrested, detained, kidnapped, depending on where you're sitting, by the Nusra Front. They also fight the Islamic State, but they are openly aligned, if not members of al-Qaeda.
Right.
And their point of view was, simply put, these guys are coming in to help the Americans bomb jihadis. We're jihadis. The Americans have on occasion bombed Nusra targets. This isn't going to work for us.
It's just another example, it sounds like, of how incredibly complicated the allegiances are in this region.
I've never seen anything like it, and I've been a foreign correspondent for 12, 13 years, and I even lived in Lebanon. And this is really just beyond comprehension. What you have here is a regime that's being backed by Iran and Hezbollah that's barely holding on to a certain amount of territory. You've got hundreds of thousands of rebels all sort of working together. You've got a giant Islamic proto-caliphate that nobody saw coming that declared itself in the middle of all of this. You've got Islamist groups that are writing editorials in the Washington Post going, really, we're not that bad for a bunch of guys who are funded by al-Qaeda. We need to work together on this problem. I spend all day just trying to figure out what's vaguely true even before I can start reporting.
And then you have Mother Nature complicating things. I read something that over the weekend or recently there was the temperatures hit 129 degrees in Baghdad, which has caused all sorts of protests, power cuts, water shortages, people saying that, at least Saddam Hussein kept the power going when it was hot during the summer. Is the deteriorating infrastructure in Iraq a bigger threat than ISIS is?
Well, let's put it this way. One of the things that whenever I speak with people who live in ISIS areas, the first thing they say is that immediately the public utilities and things get more efficient. In a lot of cases, there isn't electricity because the government controls that, but the trash gets picked up, yeah. Water, bread, all this stuff comes out. What people need to accept is in the post-US invasion environment, The Iraqis have yet to put together a government that's, you know, anything vaguely close to competent. The infrastructure in Baghdad has never been improved. Billions have been spent, mostly stolen. And so when you do get a spike, because 115, 118 degrees, that's not completely unusual this time of year. But when it pops up to 125 or so, and you've basically got you've lost the largest oil refinery in Iraq, destroyed in fighting, and then you throw in the government's bankrupt and fighting wars on several different fronts, the whole thing just sort of comes apart. I mean, you can't even call Iraq a third world country.
Mitch Prothero is Iraq bureau chief for McClatchy, speaking with us from Erbil, Iraq. Mitch, stay cool.
No, I'm in a hotel. I'm doing okay, but everybody else looks miserable.
Thanks very much.
Cheers. Bye-bye.